Hello, Level Up listeners. This is your host, Dr. Leland. Today, I'm going to try my hardest to breathe. When I started this podcast, the very beginning, I shared my journey. I shared in the middle of my journey, and now I'm sharing why it's so important for all of us to leave our legacy through words. This is why I invite you to write, whether you're writing with me in our anthology every 3 months or doing a solo project. Write, write, write. If people are telling you that you're not an author because you write an anthology, that's jealousy talking. That's ignorance talking. There is such a thing as collaborative projects. Don't let the naysayers tell you who you are and what you are and what you're gonna do. Instead, do what you want to do that makes you happy, that don't take away anybody else's happiness. Be kind, be compassionate, and be flexible. In this episode of Level Up Podcast today, I have wished that Jessica Harvey would be the one reading her chapter. I have done this 10 times now, trying to record it, and I'm hoping that the 10th time is a charm, without me losing it or crying. Today we're going to explore the story of Jessica Harvey, insights of those who are challenging the status quo and making a difference in the world. We're going to dive into conversation about a summary that I did for her, and also discussing how else we can show up for others, those who are still present with us and those who aren't. Now let me summarize Jessica Harvey's chapter in Beyond Boundaries. You can get the Beyond Boundaries book at Barnes & Noble's. You can order online at Target. You can have it at Amazon, Powell's, you name it. Now, her chapter is called The Gray Matter That Thrives Through Scarred Tissue by Jessica Harvey. And this is a summary that I've created for her chapter. I said, in The Gray Matter That Thrives Through Scarred Tissue by Jessica Harvey, shares a deeply personal narrative of resilience, mental health struggles, and self-discovery. The anthology chronicles her unique journey, marked by a left temporal lobectomy at age 17 due to a benign brain tumor, and the subsequent physical, mental, and emotional challenges she faced. Jessica's story is one of the navigating the complexities of living with epilepsy, the effects of her father's death, and the unexpected emotional aftermath of brain surgery, including severe depression and personality changes. Throughout her life, she grappled with feeling different from others, often experiencing isolation and internal conflict. Despite these challenges, she maintained a strong belief in logic and resilience, which guided her through difficult times. The anthology also explores Jessica's experiences in college, where her depression and self-destructive behaviors escalated, leading to moments of crises. However, through the support of close friends and a journey of self-reflection, she began to regain her sense of self-worth and purpose. Jessica's narrative is intertwined with reflections on her neurodivergence and how it shaped her perspective in life. She describes a period of spiritual and existential exploration, culminating in a sense of purpose through volunteering and helping others. Her anthology chapter concludes with embracing her role in making a difference in the world, particularly through her work in ESG-focused finance and her dedication to supporting individuals with cognitive, neurological, and mental health challenges. The biography at the end of the anthology highlights Jessica's professional achievements and her commitment to sustainability and helping vulnerable populations. The words of dedication reflect her gratitude towards those who have supported her and the rewarding nature of giving back to others. A couple of days ago, I received a sad news that our co-author, friend, sister, Jessica Harvey, is no longer with us. If I was to give a eulogy at her funeral, this is something I would read to her and to her friends. I would say, ladies and gentlemen, family and friends, today we gather to remember and celebrate the life of Jess, a woman whose journey was marked by profound challenges and triumphs. Jessica was a force of nature, resilient, compassionate, and deeply committed to making the world a better place, particularly in the realm of healthcare. Jessica's life was a testament to the power of perseverance. From her early years living with epilepsy to the life-altering surgery she underwent at age 17, she faced immense obstacles with a courage that was nothing short of inspiring. But it wasn't just her personal struggles that defined her. It was the way she used those experiences to advocate for others that truly set her apart. In her own words, Jessica believed that our soul's journeys are complex and unique, shaped by the challenges that we are capable of enduring. This belief guided her throughout her life, particularly in her mission to improve the way healthcare personnel care for their patients. Jessica understood firsthand the gaps in the system, the moments where empathy, understanding, and comprehensive care were lacking. Her experience fueled her passion for change, and she became a powerful voice for patients, urging healthcare providers to see beyond the diagnoses and to care for the whole person. Jessica's work in the field of ESG-focused finance was driven by the same values that guided her personal life. She was committed to sustainability, not just in terms of the environment, but in terms of human dignity and well-being. She believed that the true healthcare means treating patients with the compassion and respect they deserve, and that she dedicated herself to this cause through her advocacy, her volunteer work, and her role in mentoring others. Her involvement in our upcoming anthology, Rebel with a Cause, was a natural extension of her life's mission. Jessica wanted to shine a light on the crucial need for healthcare reform, specifically the need for healthcare personnel to take better care of their patients. She understood that healthcare is not just about curing illnesses, but about caring for the person behind the illness, understanding their fears, their hopes, and their unique journeys. Jessica's life was one of service to her profession, to her community, and to all those who needed a voice. She was a proud neurodivergent, epileptic brain tumor survivor who used her experiences to help others struggling with similar conditions. Her dedication to improving patient care will continue to inspire those who knew her and those who read her work. As we remember Jessica today, let us honor her legacy by continuing the fight she was so passionate about. Let us advocate for a healthcare system that truly cares for its patients and one that recognizes the value of empathy, compassion, and understanding. Jessica's strength, her resilience, and her commitment to others will live on in all of us who continue to carry her message forward. Rest in peace, my dear sister Jess. Your legacy of compassion and commitment to better patient care will never be forgotten. That would be my eulogy for Jessica. As promised, I'm going to read her chapter for Beyond Boundaries. She wrote this. Collaboration over competition is what I always say, and I'm so grateful and privileged to read this to you today and what she wrote. The Gray Matters That Thrives Through Scar Tissue by Jessica Harvey. My belief is that all of our souls' journeys throughout life on Earth are extremely complicated and unique, based on the obstacles we are physically, mentally, and spiritually able to handle as individuals. Though is an easier way for populations to be analyzed, I don't necessarily agree with the standard of putting people into boxes. When reminiscing over my own life, it's difficult to know where to start my story. Though experiencing left temporal lobectomy at age 17 and learning that I had been unknowingly living with a benign brain tumor for all or most of my life is when everything changed. One would think this would be an exciting, positive transformation, which is what I expected going into the surgery and how those in my life responded after the procedure. However, the side effects I was informed of by the neurological team at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, or CHOP, before agreeing to put my head under the knife were far less severe than the actual outcome I would encounter from then on onwards. Growing up, I considered myself a very lucky child in many ways. Despite my epilepsy, specifically complex partial seizures that tended to occur in clusters, no children at my school made fun of me or I failed to notice. In fact, after becoming close friends with some students in second grade, they would tell me what happened during my seizures and we would enjoy laughing together about the stories. Many of my fellow school children, including those I wasn't close with, attended my father's funeral and watched me sing Amazing Grace at age 11. And in our 8th grade yearbook, I was voted both best voice and most likely to become a rocket scientist due to my strong quantitative skills. But there also was a dark side too. My childhood. I knew internally I was mentally older than many children my age, but wasn't sure why I appeared to think differently than they did. Although I enjoyed the company of others, spending time alone to take walks in the woods and think was equally important in my life. I rarely found myself bored and would enjoy calculating combinations and permutations my fingers years before learning them. I would study crowds and to attempt to figure out how genetics worked, write songs about helping those in need and draw complex mazes. I enjoyed the responsibilities of getting my younger siblings ready for school each morning as well, in replacement of my father. I felt confident that even if I didn't end up experiencing the best childhood, I had future successes as an adult waiting ahead. But to be honest about my father's passing, I felt relief more than anything, friends and extended family viewed him as a funny, entertaining person to be around, which was true. Yet, there was another side of him only those closest to him had to experience, involving alcohol abuse, anger, and aggression. At around the same time as his passing, my neurologist said it was appropriate to wean me off my anti-seizure medication after being seizure-free for a year. I didn't expect that a couple months later I would experience an uncomfortable moment with a family friend, but believed that the incident would only cause my mother more pain, given the man would visit the grave often to converse with my father. I believe I didn't need to bring anyone else into one-time event. Perhaps that's partially to blame for never being seizure-free again after returning to medications. As I entered high school, where I only formally knew 5 students, I became less social as I began to more keenly notice my differences in personality compared to the norm, and felt most comfortable having conversations with smaller groups or one-on-ones. I was never part of any particular clique, so when waiting for assemblies to start, I preferred to hide in the nearby bathroom instead of standing in a group where I felt I wasn't wanted. My schoolmates meant well, but some former friends would say that, in terms of me thinking more literally than most, I was so far down at the bottom of the box that I would never think outside of it. Now, reflecting back, I wonder which box this was, given I felt dissimilar to most people in terms of our thinking concepts, and instead of believe that difference gave me true freedom of thought and expression. Today, that box might be neurodivergence. When college planning, my mother didn't want me to leaving the house, still having seizures. I started listening to the professionals at CHOP suggest I consider neurosurgery, as many medications had failed to work 100%. I was the only one aware that I was independently taking public transportation around to see movies by myself, and no strangers even noticed when I once had a seizure alone. However, I still feared revealing that fact at the time, perhaps because that would take some of my life away from me. Instead, the medical field sounded confident about the procedure. All of the neurophysiological tests sounded promising, and I felt strangely excited about this particular WADA test. I'd be undergoing which would turn off each hemisphere of my brain separately to test my memory. Now, the day of that examination was the only day of high school I missed. As the surgery approached, in between my junior and senior years, I started to question if I was making the right decision. Nevertheless, I had a much stronger belief in logic and proofs than intuition, and so I chose to rationally trust what the medical professional shared. They mentioned potential side effects such as blind spots and migraines, etc., but nothing that sounded seriously or chronically damaging. I wonder to this day if their advice would have been different if they foreknew the outcome of the existence of a benign tumor behind the scarred tissue, which increased since the surgery they were aiming to remove. Now, immediately following the recovery from physical pain, I noticed, as well as the other relatives, that my personality had changed. My uncle congratulated me on appearing normal, which I took internal offense to, as I had never wanted to be viewed or wired in the way most people appeared, and had secretly taken pride in my uniqueness. The change that impacted me most was severe depression, which I had to hide because everyone was happy for me. My mother didn't believe in such disorders, and neurology at the time considered psychiatry a pseudoscience, even when aware that the temporal lobe controls emotions through the amygdala. As I discovered, this was the first true disability I was experiencing, and that it wasn't accepted as one to many people, I realized life was about to become a lot harder to endure. One thing that did take a while to change, though, was my view of logic. When in college, I attempted to seek medical help through therapies and psychiatrists. Therapists, unfortunately, blame my issues on my drinking, only on the weekends for college parties, which I hadn't done in high school. Instead of recognizing that my drinking was in response to my depression and missing my previous self, rather than the other way around, psychiatrists, meanwhile, probably didn't want me to be involved in medicating me due to my complex history and the number of Americans who sue when something goes wrong. Now, I saw their perspective as logical and wasn't offended, so I continued to distract myself as best as I could. For some reason, I never thought that any of this experience was at the level of trauma until many years later when it was finally treated. I survived college due to my close group of friends that really took shape at the beginning of sophomore year and by miracle. After giving up alcohol for Lent sophomore year, I only had a bit to drink at a party we went to early Easter morning before my boyfriend started screaming at me. I went home alone and received a phone call from his taxi driver using his cell phone, so I paid for it to come to my dormitory and sent him a Facebook message informing him. Then I decided to drink from the bottle of mixed alcohol I had taken from my family's place. I don't remember taking over-the-counter painkillers, but found them when I woke up on the floor with vomit on my face and pills all over the place. I saw my friend who lived in the same dorm standing over me, telling me that I needed to get up to my elevated bed unless I wanted to be removed from on-campus housing. I started telling her how I couldn't, how painful it was, but somehow I eventually was able to get up the ladder and land on my stomach. I texted her the next day, thanking her for being there for me, but she said she had stayed over her then-boyfriend's place. I was too sick all day to think about what had actually happened, and the next week my boyfriend slapping me in the face trumped what was going through my mind. Now, it wouldn't be for another 2 years around the time of our graduation in 2011 that I would remember what occurred. My senior year, my drinking and depression had worsened, though I continued getting decent grades and interning full-time with my friend, who I thought had saved me and was then living with. The drinking was definitely a mutual flaw among many of my friends, though we also had the commonality of being smart enough to still do well academically. But with this friend in particular, it started to become a problem for her a couple months after we met as freshmen. During summer break, when her grandmother, who raised her and wasn't much older than my mother, died, we became close when she called me crying, telling me everything that had happened. But I, of course, wasn't able to fix the tragedy. Once we lived together, we were both going through some new, sad, painful experiences that worsened our depression and trauma, and together distracted ourselves at bars and parties. Now, at the point when spring semester started, I was so depressed that after drinking, I fell asleep in the snow. I did go to some AA meetings, but their stories were so much more drastic than mine, but I told myself I was fine. Meanwhile, one of the girls in our friend group randomly decided to scream at my roommate and then avoid her for months. After spring break, our whole group of friends was beginning to fall apart. I thankfully spent mine working a few days, then visiting family. But all three groups who traveled came back hating one of their attendees. It wasn't until then that the friend who had ranted at my roommate came crawling back. Many people's stress and issues came out on the other people, but I realized that mine came out almost always as growing self-hatred. About a month before graduation, my still boyfriend stopped over and, based on my clear depression, broke up with me by telling me to figure myself out. Surprisingly to me, it actually was starting to work. It wasn't immediate, but over the next couple of weeks, I began realizing everything that had gotten me to where I was. And suddenly, I was able to love myself once again. After that, I worked with my friends to get them to move past whatever drama had occurred for the time we had left together, including senior week tickets to the same events. And with other friends, as smartphones were becoming increasingly popular, I reminded them of the importance of living in the moment. Once I had helped them work out their issues, I felt bored and wondered what to do next. Now, I remember that the summer before, I had discovered one of the few secrets I still had to myself, the memory of when I was 10 and woke up in the middle of the night having what I thought were pleasant seizures that I was able to control myself into and out of, suddenly seemed to have been an experience of speaking in tongues, which I now view as astral projection or light language. I was mildly high from cannabis in my room and jokingly asked God or a higher power if there were to actually be an apocalypse the next year in 2012. Whether I could have a role in saving people from whatever were to happen. But after that, things around me started to become intensely strange. I can't remember the order of signs. I started to see and experience, though I recall being able to walk ridiculously fast and having a number of people stare at me as though they didn't know what they were looking at. I was starting to have great conversations with strangers, such as an older man at Foxwoods Casino, who was mesmerized at my response to his rhetorical question regarding why so many younger people had to be all dressed up for gambling. As I was walking from one friend was to another. Now, our conversation ended with him telling me that I had given him a lot more hope in my generation. Now, I started to become more fearful when my family members and friends arrived for my graduation in a huge mansion outside of Boston that was then inexpensive to rent. Now, unlike strangers who enjoyed my new self, my family strangely did not. My siblings refused to speak to me based on whatever philosophy I was discussing, and my mom simply rolled her eyes and said I didn't look healthy after losing a significant amount of weight since they last saw me. I stayed for a while, although many people were drunk when I showed up late, then returned to Boston. The next day, Friday, was my graduation from the business school. Saturday was my planned graduation party at the mansion, and Sunday was the university-wide ceremony. Now, because our School of Management, or SMG, was also jokingly an abbreviation for sex, money, and greed, I decided to do one-up my hair and wear a green dress and gold sandals on Friday. Now, after the ceremony and taking photos, I took ferry with my mom and aunt to return to the suburbs to have dinner out with everyone. Now, on the boat, we met a woman who had attended the graduation and used to work with my father. That was when I started getting chills. Before going to dinner, my aunt noticed that one of my dress straps had strangely broken with no visible tears or used a safety pin to fix it. Now, at the restaurant, I was anxious about returning to Boston since my friend group was meeting up that night at my friend's apartment. And I had an instinctive and correct feeling it would be the last time that all of us would be together. I appreciated anyone who had traveled to see me, but suddenly became more alarmed by the manner in which my uncle said to me, "It's not the end of the world." Obviously, I knew it is an expression, but seemed to mean it in a different context, and I just looked into his eyes seriously and startled, not knowing what to say. Thankfully, without question, my paternal grandparents drove me back to Boston to see my friend, drunkenly saying, "Whoa, it's the end of the world." When my friends then decided to split up, I chose to go with my ex-boyfriend and our guy friends to a calm rooftop party. I was processing a lot and talking to a girl I met who had earlier noticed me at the ceremony. While noticing myself that a huge pointed-looking amount of fog was quickly entering the city from the ocean. Now, as we left, a friend with possible autism went chasing after it. My ex ran away from us, and our other friend knew that I was well enough to get myself home. I noticed on the walk that my other dress strap had mysteriously broken. Now, as I returned home, I immediately looked up the news about an apocalypse I had not heard of that was supposed to occur at the exact time of my graduation party. I returned back to the suburbs earlier in that day as the fog intensified and even scared my most atheist friend and her mother on their drive. As the time got closer, I prayed for God to delay it and all was fine. The following day after the general ceremony, a couple of friends, including her, came over again. This time she asked our group of four if anyone else was feeling this sense of weird energy, and our other friend shivered. I finally could confirm that this wasn't just in my head, and I realized that given the number of 30 birthday parties the group of us had encountered had become an inside joke that age was probably when the apocalypse would return. Now, so it was at the end of 2019 with COVID-19. My golden year of 31 years old was when the pandemic became serious in the U.S., and I immediately started to volunteer to get food to those in poverty through outdoor markets in NYC. I also joined the BLM protest from the starting the weekend and have volunteered with autistic children in Tanzania since then. Additionally, my psychiatrist had severe brain fog after catching COVID and finally decided to take the risk of prescribing me antidepressants as I had long needed. Though circumstances have certainly not been generally thought of as going uphill since then, through darkness, perhaps at the bottom of a protective box, often shines the light we need to finally realize what we're meant to do. I interpret the dress occurrence to indicate that I may not be wealthy, as my name means in Hebrew, in terms of money, but in terms of what difference I can make for others. Ladies and gentlemen, that is the end of Jessica Harvey's chapter. I'm going to read to you what she wrote as her short bio. She wrote, "Jessica is an ASG-focused finance professional committed to making our world more sustainable by helping a large corporate and investment bank calibrate interim industry portfolio-based greenhouse gas emissions, intensity reduction targets for their financing, evaluating in-scope clients quantitatively and quantitatively based on her team's climate transition framework, and working with bankers to assist clients with their goals to reduce with carbon footprint. She's proudly neurodivergent, epileptic brain tumor and sepsis followed by the months of neuroinflammation survivor, dedicated to helping others struggling with cognitive, neurological, and or mental health conditions, particularly those from more vulnerable backgrounds than herself. Though her employee resource group role at work, her college student mentoring role, her involvement on nonprofit associate boards, her connections to international impoverished villages after volunteering with special needs children in Africa, and everyday interactions." The last paragraph I'm going to read to you is Jessica's dedication to her support team. "Along with my supportive friends, I have mainly those who assist voluntarily to thank for by becoming the entity driven by helping the vulnerable I am today. The more I support others, the more rewarding my life becomes. And I believe that this is true for everyone. This photo," she took a photo with the children in Tanzania, by the way, "of me volunteering in Arusha, Tanzania, teaching and playing with primary school children with autism. I also would like to thank the people I randomly meet in New York, from those experiencing homelessness to strangers with epilepsy I encounter at restaurants, to thank for their wise words and or returned help I could offer them. Without these individuals, I would not be the whole. For those who would like to connect with me, I can be reached on my LinkedIn." Brothers and sisters out there, that is the end of Jessica Harvey's Beyond Boundaries chapter. A week and a half ago, Jess and I were talking because she signed up to be in my next anthology called Rebel with a Cause. I spoke to Jess on exactly what her chapter would look like. And if you are listening to this and it's not August 15th, please DM me your message of 2 to 3 maximum sentences of your interaction with Jess and what she's like. Describe her to me. I'm going to add it to our anthology, Rebel with a Cause, under Jessica's chapter. as a dedication to her and her family. The proceeds to this book will also go to either mental health awareness nonprofit organization or autism for children and young adults. That is my commitment to Jessica and her legacy. I'm also creating a Rebel with a Cause journal. That proceeds will also go to another nonprofit that Jessica loves, which is, again, autism or neurodivergent nonprofit organization. Please help me. Please help me honor Jessica, whether you know her or you don't. Help our community. We are global citizens. Help our community. Be strong. Be more compassionate. Be more understanding. And take everything from love. If you feel bad energy from people, it's okay to love them from far away. If you tried your hardest to love somebody, love your friend, love your sister or brothers, but it feels like they're dragging you down in your mental well-being, it's okay to love them from far. Surround yourself with positivity. Lead with your heart. Add more compassion to your repertoire every day. Add gratefulness. Work in yourself, not on gossiping with other people. If you're going to gossip, gossip about how many people you have helped in our world, in our tribe, in our community. Align yourself with someone who truly does the work, not just by words. Align yourself with someone who doesn't talk bad about others. Align yourself where you are celebrated, not just tolerated. Reciprocate energy, especially good ones. If you surround yourself with negative people constantly, you're going to squeeze and gain toxicity. If you are going through pain, please reach out to someone. If you're feeling that this is the end of your life, please reach out to someone. Stay positive. Have hope. Give grace to yourself. No one is perfect. No one. Have a hyper focus on your purpose. Turn your pain into purpose for your people. We are global citizens. And this is your host, Dr. Leland from Level Up Academy. Jess is smiling upon us. Take a moment to have a deep breath and smile. Be happy she's no longer in pain. Be happy that you're able to listen to this. Be grateful that you are still alive and you can make a difference. Let's continue the legacy, everybody. I'm hoping you will have a beautiful day, beautiful week, and celebrate each other. I will see you on my live stream or audio room on the next podcast. Bye.